Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On June 6, 1944, a day commonly known as D-Day, the Western Allies invaded northern France. It was the largest amphibious assault in history. It has become a day cemented in legend. Films like The Longest Day, Saving Private Ryan, series on TV like Band of Brothers, created a popular idea of D-Day and what that was like. But it was much, much more than that. A new book, When the Sea Came Alive, a oral history of D-Day, provides a modern examination of the experience and the importance of D-Day. And we're joined by the author and historian Garrett M. Graff. And Garrett, welcome back to The Source.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what is the the delta between the popular idea of what D-Day was and what your understanding of it now that you've put together this book, you've written this book?
Yeah. So as you said, this week marks the 80th anniversary of D-Day and will be the subject of some big festivities in France over the next couple of days. And I thought it was an important and poignant moment to step back and look at that day anew, because in many ways, the 80th anniversary represents the final passing of the greatest generation as well. You know, on D-Day, there were a million Allied personnel in movement across England and the English Channel. And today we're down to the last few thousand of them. England actually estimates that there are just six living D-Day veterans left in Great Britain. And so for me, the goal of trying to do this as an oral history was to try to pull together the voluminous first-person records that we have of that day at a moment when we now have effectively every first-person memory we will ever have of D-Day. And so to try to tell the story of that day, one of the biggest, most important days in all of human history, in the voices of the people who experienced it at a moment when D-Day was beginning to slip from living memory permanently into history.
Our phone lines are open. If you had a relative of yours, family members, told you about their experiences on D-Day, or what are your thoughts about D-Day, the sacrifices that were made that day? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org and text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. So, Garrett, the fact that we have anyone still alive from an event that happened 80 years ago is kind of shows us that how young people were at the time that they took part in D-Day.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that really comes out as you get into this story is it is the incredible youth of so many of these participants, paratroopers, 17, 18, 19 years old, some of them, 19-year-old paratroopers who were actually on their third foreign invasion, having participated in North Africa and Sicily and Italy in 1942 and 1943, that what you saw, I think that really stands out is, the way that this was a operation carried out at the ground level by often teenagers and the grizzled veteran sergeants who are leading them are all of 21, 22 years old. And that, it is, I think, really incredible as you get into these stories to understand the burden that fell to this generation in terms of defending American democracy and winning World War II.
Describe the title, When the Sea Came Alive. Who said that?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that I find always appealing about oral history, that one of the reasons that I think it's important to try to tell stories in the voices of the people who lived them, is that when you write narrative history, and I've certainly written plenty of narrative history myself, there's a tendency, no matter how hard you try, to make events seem neater, cleaner, simpler, more organized, more linear, more predetermined than anyone who was experiencing it that day actually felt. You know, no one who woke up on the morning of June 6th knew how June 6th was going to end. And the quote of the title, When the Sea Came Alive, is actually from a German defender from Omaha Beach, who talks about, you know, waking up that morning and looking out of his bunker and seeing and being totally surprised by the massive Allied armada now offshore. And, you know, he says the sea had come alive. And, you know, one of the things that stands out again as you get into these first-person voices and experiences is the picture that we tell of D-Day, of, you know, these five beaches, the two American beaches, Utah and Omaha, the British sector beaches, Juno, Sword, and Gold. You know, the parachute drops of the 82nd and 101st Airborne along the western flank, the British 6th Airborne along the eastern flank. You know, that's not the understanding that any of the German defenders had of that day as they lived it. You know, the Germans were almost totally taken by surprise that morning and spent so much of the day trying to piece together the picture of, you know, how many invasions there were, how many beaches there were, where the paratroopers had actually dropped, who had dropped where, and to try, even as, you know, the Americans severed communication links and made it ever harder for them to develop that picture of the day, the Germans spent so much of D-Day itself confused about what was happening around them.
And that was deliberate. American and British forces were trying to confuse them, had done everything they could to confuse them.
Absolutely. And I spent a couple of chapters in the book talking about those sort of secrecy and deception operations that the Allies had run to try to keep the Germans from thinking even that once the Normandy invasion had launched, whether that was actually the main invasion.
We got to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. We do want to hear from you folks out there about your family who served in World War II and how you feel about that today. Particularly if they served during D-Day. I want to hear those stories. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book just out, When the Sea Came Alive, A Oral History of D-Day. We're with the author, Garrett M. Graff. He is a best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize finalist. And this is a new look, a fresh look at D-Day, a modern look, with the perspective that we now have that it will be 80 years on the 6th that this thing happened. And which each passing year we've lost more veterans, more of the people who actually experienced this, but also we gain the perspective of history. So Garrett, what are the benefits of histories, the perspective here?
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes from being able to write, effectively 80 years after an event like this, is there has been time for the history's original oversights to be at least partially corrected. The story of D-Day is, of course, overwhelmingly white and male. But it is not exclusively white and male. And I spent a lot of effort in this book to try to tell the stories of the women who helped with the D-Day effort, many of whom had been overlooked in early histories of D-Day, as well as the stories of particularly Black soldiers that had been overlooked in earlier histories of D-Day. And that includes both some of the surprising racial tensions that took place in England as the segregated American military arrived in a country that had no history of segregation at home. And it also involved the heroism of the Black soldiers themselves. And in fact, this is a story that continues right up to the present day. One of the main characters in the book is Staff Sergeant Waverly Woodson Jr., who was a combat medic with the one Black combat unit that landed on the D-Day beaches on June 6th. And he landed on Omaha Beach about 3 hours after the invasion began, was wounded even before he made it to shore, then spent 30 hours treating the wounded on Omaha Beach before being evacuated himself. He treated somewhere, historians later estimated, to about 200 casualties on Omaha Beach himself, was considered at the time for the Medal of Honor. He was one of just four Black soldiers in all of World War II to be considered for the Medal of Honor at the time. But amid the racism of the segregated military at the time, not a single Black soldier in all of World War II received the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award for combat valor. And he, the effort to sort of recognize that Black heroism continued. The Clinton administration in the 1990s put together a special commission to award some medals of honor to Black soldiers in World War II. And Waverly Woodson was not one of them because his paperwork had been lost by the Pentagon by then. And it was actually only this week, after an enormous effort by historians and archivists in the military and outside of the military to sort of resurrect and recreate his record, that they were able to award Waverly Woodson a Distinguished Service Cross. The Pentagon just announced yesterday on Monday that he will receive the nation's second highest award for combat bravery. And it's, I think, an incredible recognition for Waverly Woodson, but also an important moment for us to realize that the history of D-Day, even 80 years later, is still evolving.
Let's listen to a voicemail that we received.
This is Michael. We should honor those who lost their lives in World War II, and most important, honor those families who lost their young loved ones in defeating the vicious totalitarian dictatorships of Germany and Japan, by ensuring that our country does not repeat the mistakes of the 1930s that encouraged and allowed Germany's and Japan's criminal aggression. I think by not calling Russia and China the vicious totalitarian dictatorships which they are, and not opposing them today, shows a lack of respect for the work and sacrifice of the American people in the Second World War. We must stop American support for the current Russian aggression, and Americans must stop building Chinese industrial and military strength by not buying the products made by the enslaved labor of the Chinese Communist government. My family lost one in-law in October 1944 in France, and two blood relatives in the Pacific in 1945, and some very old members of my family still remember those boys. Thank you very much for taking this call.
So, Garrett, the idea of the sacrifices, honoring the sacrifices by preventing or thinking about what can we do to prevent another, the necessity of another D-Day. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, Ronald Reagan, who really helped reconceptualize and reframe D-Day with his speech at the 40th anniversary in 1984 at Pointe du Hoc, the cliffs where the Rangers so courageously climbed that day to try to destroy and capture a German gun battery. Ronald Reagan said in one of his speeches, democracy is only ever one generation away from extinction. And I think that one of the reasons that this book and this memory feels so poignant and important to me in this year is as America has this election where we're spending so much of this year talking about what America is and what it isn't. And at a very simple level, America is what we are willing to fight for. And the Greatest Generation was willing to fight to preserve democracy both at home and abroad. And they did so recognizing in many ways that America was still an imperfect country, but that they the invasion launched on D-Day, the cross-channel invasion of Operation Overlord, was one of the only invasions in human history ever launched not to seize or to conquer, but to liberate. It was among the most noble causes humans have ever fought in their life, in our existence. And that, to me, I think a big part of remembering that bravery and recognizing and memorializing that bravery and courage back then is to think about and force a conversation about what we are doing to defend democracy in the modern age as well.
My dad was a World War II veteran. I still have some of those books, those pocket books, guides that they supplied to them. I have them in my bookshelf. Not the one that you quote in your book, The Pocket Guide to France. And you have the quote that the Allied, and this is what they informed the soldiers, this was issued by the military, the Allied offensive that you're taking part in is based upon a hard-boiled fact. It's this: we democracies aren't just doing favors and fighting for each other when history gets tough. We're all in the same boat. Take a look around you as you move into France, and you'll see what the Nazis do to a democracy when they get when they can get it done down by itself. So the soldiers were informed that this was about fighting for democracy. This was about fighting for freedom. This is what they knew what they were doing.
Yes, and they were very clear-eyed about this. This was about going to get Hitler and keep the world and keep Europe free and lift from it the shadow of Nazi totalitarianism. And, I think one of the interesting aspects of the book is about the first third of the book is about the planning and logistics of D-Day, of the buildup and the run-up and the organization that led to it. And a big part of that is how the British and American governments and militaries are learning to cooperate and be allies, that you see, I think, we sort of have this story of, you know, Britain and America have always been great allies, you know, special relationship, our closest partner. But really, it took a couple of years for America and Britain to end up on the same side, fighting the same fight in World War II. And there's this incredible moment in the book where we're talking about the events of December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor. And Winston Churchill talks about how he slept so well that night because for the first time, he was sure that England would be saved. That he knew Hitler would be defeated, Mussolini would be defeated, Japan, he said, would be ground to dust. And that for him, he understood that once America had been awakened and angered, there was going to be no stopping what America's military might and industrial might was going to be able to bring to the fight.
So at the time, there was this America First movement that was very popular to prevent the United States from entering the war in Europe against Hitler. We have an America First movement today trying to keep America from helping Ukraine against Russia. Do you see similarities?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that this is... you know, it is hard not to think about the events that President Biden and other world leaders are holding in Normandy this week and not think about the fact that there is a land war taking place on the continent where the Normandy landings took place in 1944, that there is a real effort to roll back Western democracy on the continent of Europe.
And so the Ronald Reagan quote resonates even more so, that we're only one generation from losing it all.
Absolutely. America's story, our history, our shared history has always been of an imperfect nation seeking generation by generation to make a better country. And that when you look at the legacy we have as a country, that is what we have to hand down generation to generation. And to me, I hope everyone who reads this book has the opportunity to think back and think about what legacy we are going to hand down to the next generation of democracy.
We're going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about what did the popular media, what do we know about D-Day as it was happening, and how did we get there and mobilizing and the industrial might, the scale and the complexity of that day, and what were the surprises that occurred on D-Day? The number to call in if you got questions or comments, memories, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the book, When the Sea Came Alive, An Oral History of D-Day, joined by the author, Garrett M. Graff. So why did you decide to make this an oral history? And typically, I don't like oral histories in books. They're really hard to follow, but this one is not like that. So how did you make this work?
Thanks. I'm happy to hear that. I think that oral history it has its sort of time and place, particularly in moments like this where there are such large archives of material to work with. I wrote a similar oral history of 9/11 that came out about 5 years ago, a book called The Only Plane in the Sky, and that pulled together about 480 voices from that day, morning to night, coast to coast, as 9/11 unfolded. 9/11, of course, the most famous day of the 21st century. D-Day, arguably, I think, the most famous single day, the most famous single turning point of the 20th century. And so to me, this was a day that really lent itself to this kind of storytelling and the use of the first person voices. I ended up amassing in my research about 5,000 individual participants in the day, oral histories, official reports, battlefield citations, video testimonials, newspaper and magazine articles, TV, radio transcripts, memoirs, historical society pamphlets and the like. And then sort of slowly wove this story together. The finished product is about 700 voices from all sides of that event. It's not just the Allied troops, it's the leaders of that day. It was the British and American and French civilians and German defenders. And I think that first person perspective on the day really helps bring some fresh light and detail and texture to the way that we remember D-Day 80 years on. You know, we sort of all feel like we know the story of D-Day. We know the five beaches. We know, Eisenhower and Churchill and Roosevelt. But it's a story, I think, that when you break it down, is this incredible story of individual strength and courage and heroism. But it's also this really fascinating case study in leadership, that first third of the book where you see the big names, the Roosevelts, the Churchills, the Montgomerys and Eisenhower. It's the story of these titanic historic figures. Well, then you get to June 6th, 1944 itself, and there's not a single thing that any of those big leaders can do by 6:30 on Tuesday morning, June 6th, to change the outcome of D-Day. And that then it becomes the story of all of these small decisions made individually by the young leaders, the corporals, the sergeants, the lieutenants, who rally forward their shattered comrades, organize and fight the best that they can. But they fight in interesting and innovative and imaginative and entrepreneurial ways that day.
And you think that made a difference?
Against Germans.
The fact that
against Germans who can't. The German sort of model of leadership is so different they were hierarchical. They were, they had sort of confused chains of command. And they're just not able to sort of fight and think as innovatively and smartly as the Americans are. And to me, there's like this amazing thread that comes out as you watch America basically defeat Germany in the moment by thinking smarter and more entrepreneurially than the Germans are able to.
And the audio version of the book, do you have the sound of these voices? Do you get to hear the different accents and textures of these voices?
Yeah, certainly in some of the oral histories, they're recorded as videos or cassette tapes that I heard as I was doing the research. The audiobook, I've got to tell you, for this, it is really just incredible. They recorded it with a full cast, and so you do hear all of those accents and voices, British, Canadian, Norwegian, German, French, American, Southern, white, black, and that I think the book, no pun intended, comes alive in the audiobook because it ends up really capturing the symphony and tapestry of voices that unfold, throughout this, most audacious day of human history.
I got an email from a listener, Joanne Thompson, says, my uncle's plane was shot down over Austria in April 1945. I only knew of him from my daddy and the picture my grandmother kept in her bedroom of her pinning on his Army Air Corps wings. He was 21 when he died along with his crew. Several years ago, I was able to get in touch with an Austrian man who had a hobby of collecting debris from airplanes that were downed during the war. He had found parts of my uncle's aircraft and a pair of boots from one of the victims. He actually had a small war museum attached to the inn that he runs. When I thanked him for sharing this information with me, he told me it was an honor to speak to the niece of Malcolm Conway. I'd like to think that his gratitude for what our military did is shared with others in Europe. Do the people in Europe feel that way?
I think they do, and I think you'll see that on display this week through the ceremonies and remembrances in Normandy. I had the chance last year when I was doing research for the book to travel to Normandy and to spend some time there. Those communities really do take preserving the history of that day, preserving the stories and memories of that day very seriously. They understand the stakes of what transpired. They understand how, the Allied troops came to France to liberate and how unique that is in all of human history. And I think that you will see sort of the best and warmest hospitality from France this week for the tiny handful of returning veterans who are still alive and returning. I think the number is something like 60 D-Day veterans have returned this year for this 80th anniversary.
During D-Day 1944, I mean, it was clear that there would be an invasion. Fortress Europe had to be breached. There had to be an attempt by the Allies. It was a question of where and when. It seems obvious that Normandy, those beaches, it was close to England. It would be a quick trip to there. Why wasn't it obvious to the Germans?
Yeah, we were talking about this, I think, just a little bit before the break, where as you said, everyone knew that an invasion was coming in 1944. What the Germans didn't know and what the Allies kept secret was where the invasion would take place and when. And that those two very specific details became the whole of the secrecy cloak around the D-Day operation. And I have a couple chapters in the book devoted to all of the feints and deception operations and spycraft that went into trying to mislead the Germans about where the Normandy invasion would take place. Not just in France, but in Europe. There was an enormous effort actually throughout 1944 to make the Germans think that the first invasion would come against Norway, and that and then within France, the invasion would come not in Normandy, but in the Pas-de-Calais region, which in many ways was on paper sort of a smarter place to invade. It was a shorter distance across the channel. It had good, strong port facilities that the Allies could use to to build up supplies. But that what you see on that day is that the deception operations were so effective that the Germans still don't believe at the end of D-Day that this is the main invasion, and they don't bring forward all of their reinforcements because they think that there's still an invasion coming against Pas-de-Calais.
Taking another break, our phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you, talk about your memories, what you've heard about from your family, about D-Day, World War II. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is When the Sea Came Alive, An Oral History of D-Day. The author with us, Garrett M. Graff. In the movies, we've seen like in Private Ryan and other films that really tell the story of how gruesome D-Day was. You see, you know, the landing craft get to the beach. They drop that front ramp, and then like all the soldiers are just getting just shot. They're just like just, you know, they don't even get off the landing craft. The minute they're exposed, they're just wiped out. I mean, was that how it really was?
It was, depending on where exactly you were on the beach and at what hour you were on the beach. You know, I think in many ways the emotional core or center of this book is the chapters about the first wave at Omaha Beach, which is that famous killing ground from the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan. You have there Company A of the 116th Infantry Regiment of the 29th Division come ashore at the western end of the beach by what's now known as the Vierville Draw, the sort of Vierville beach exit. And they're the first wave to hit Omaha Beach and are the unit almost exclusively comes from small towns around Bedford, Virginia. It's a former federalized National Guard unit and that had been part of the Virginia National Guard. And it was, Company A was almost entirely wiped out. They leave the troop ships that morning with 230 men in the company, and by the end of the day there are just 18 left unscathed. Everyone else is killed or wounded, and the company right behind them, Company B, another federalized National Guard unit, they end the day, they start with a similar size and end the day with about 28 people left standing. The carnage of those first waves is really just tremendous. Now, first hour of the day turns to the second hour of the day, that's where you begin to see training begin to kick in among the shattered units still left on the beach. You begin to see that incredible leadership and heroism and courage that we were talking about a little bit earlier, as these units are rallied forward, you know, by a corporal here, a sergeant there, a lieutenant there, and they begin to turn the tide at Omaha. And by about 9 a.m., there are already American units making their way up to the cliffs over the beach, beginning to actually penetrate the Atlantic Wall. And it's a testament, again, to the leadership and the bravery of those officers out there in the field that are able to, seize victory from the jaws of defeat in those first 2 hours at Omaha.
Let's go to a caller. Is it Christine? Christine?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, it is Christine. Okay. I did not have any family members who fought, but I am a mom to two young boys. One is about to turn 15. And just thinking about that, I mean, some of these soldiers were not much older than my own son is now. And it just reminds me of the importance of protecting our democracy, and to stay apolitical, but the importance of ensuring we support Ukraine, the importance of ensuring that, if whoever wins the presidency, it is the power is, given. And some of the things I'm seeing in our politics today, it's just very frightening, because I was watching a show on CNN, and one of the veterans said, like, never again. And this is what's scary as a mom, is it looks like some of us are not taking this seriously. Like, why would we want to, why don't we ensure that world peace is given the most important value? Because this is going to impact our children. I can't imagine what some of those soldiers went through.
Christine, thank you for the call. Garrett, can you react to that?
Yeah. Absolutely. And, the youth of these soldiers and sailors and airmen is just so striking. I talk about in the book Edward Bacalia, who was the coxswain of LCT 589 at Omaha Beach. He was 17 years old that day, and wasn't going to turn 18 until September of 1944. And he piloted a landing craft onto Omaha Beach on D-Day, not just once, but twice.
And so was there a chance that D-Day could have been a disaster, that it could have been a Dunkirk kind of a thing? Although the U.S. and the Allies arrived with overwhelming forces, had the Germans, we never know. In the fog of war, what could have gone badly?
Yeah, I think part of the picture that you get when you dive into this history is every Allied amphibious invasion of World War II succeeded, in part because they were such risky operations that the U.S. military and the Allied military devoted such overwhelming force to them.
But, the landing at Sicily, the landing in Italy were nothing like this.
Right. And so the challenge, I think, of D-Day was never going to be, could the Allies not pierce the Atlantic Wall? The challenge was going to be, could they hold on in the first 24 hours, first 48 hours, first 72 hours? As the Germans began to bring up their reinforcements. And that, I think, is one of the things that was really surprising, even to the Allies, was how slow the Germans were to react. That had they reacted a little bit differently, had they reacted a little bit more aggressively, had they brought up reinforcements a little bit more quickly, they could have turned a couple of those beaches into a real nasty fight.
And so about 18 months later after D-Day, the war in Europe is over?
Yeah, just about a year, April 1945, and then the war against Japan continues, of course, through August, when the dropping of the atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And but you are right that I think part of this, and I try to make this point in the final chapters of the book, that D-Day, in many ways, while it was the day that the Allies had been planning for 2 years, D-Day was just the beginning. It wasn't the end. And that the fight for Normandy, the Normandy campaign, actually stretched itself for 77 days after the original invasion, including some very nasty and bitter fighting. And that the, for all of the soldiers who made it ashore on D-Day, you know, they had to wake up June 7th and just keep fighting.
What was it like for you to write this book? I mean, you've done a lot of histories, different types of examinations of history. How does this fit in?
I think any book is, you find that the research surprises you in different ways. And for me, what surprised me was how much of this book ends up being about the events that take place before D-Day. You sort of think that I'm writing a book about D-Day, it's the story of June 6, 1944. But in so many ways, D-Day begins 2 years earlier with the planning, with the buildup of the American troops and material in Great Britain, the Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, and that there had been so much set in motion by the time D-Day actually happened.
I'm almost out of time, but is it true that more lives were lost training for D-Day than actually on D-Day itself?
Yes, that's a statistic that I track and follow in the book, and recently sort of calculated by historian Peter Caddick Adams, and the story of how some of those training exercises went so awry was to me one of the biggest surprises of researching this book.
But necessary?
Absolutely necessary, and I think any of the Allied commanders would tell you that as great as the cost was in the training, that the lives that were lost in the training saved lives on D-Day,
and saved Europe.
And saved Europe. Yeah, that was what it was. The training that the Allies did that let the Allies succeed.
The book is When the Sea Came Alive: An Oral History of D-Day. Garrett Imgraff, thank you so much for coming on board today, talking about this, reminding us of the importance of the sacrifices made on D-Day. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for remembering this week.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.